Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Salmons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brenna McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill in West Roxbury and the banks of the electronic Charles.
Have you seen the Charles at all in the last few weeks?
Yeah, I was down at BU. I was down at BU on Sunday.
Yeah, and, the lower Charles.
Yeah, the lower Charles, where it opens up into the bay there.
Did it seem prepared for the onslaught of Boston University students?
Nothing is prepared for that. Neither buildings nor faculty nor river are prepared for that.
I'm certainly not prepared. I'm devoting the rest of the day this afternoon to trying to figure out how I'm supposed to do all this electronic teaching and lecture for an hour and a half in a mask.
Yeah.
So we're going to see. I guess I'm going to practice that. What are you having for breakfast this morning?
A bagel and a glass of orange juice.
All right. Classic, simple. I'm going to have my two eggs over easy with toast, some sausage.
And a lot of bacon, I'm sure.
And home fries. And bacon. Oh, our guest is already
here. Our guest knows you well.
He's ready to go. I will introduce our guest, our special guest, to our loyal listener. We have been promising our audience that we're going to do a series of special shows running up to our 100th episode. So we are into our 92nd episode of The Historians, and we are fulfilling our promise to have special shows in the 90s with our guest today, who is none other than Professor Kort Roflob of Brown University, who was my Roman history professor in my graduate studies at Brown, and much more than that. And it would take me a long time to go through his career, but I want to give our listeners some appreciation for the career of Professor Roflob. After studying in Basel and Hamburg, he taught at the Freie Universität in Berlin before coming to Brown University in 1978, if I have that year right.
Yeah.
And then taught at Brown pretty much straight through until 2009, but did some very interesting things in the middle of that. He, of course, became a professor of classics, then professor of classics and history. Then he was the John Rowe Workman Distinguished Professor of Classics and the Humanistic Tradition, and eventually the David Herlihy University Professor and Professor of Classics and History. And David Herlihy was my medieval history professor at Brown University, and a wonderful guy.
Great guy. And his wife, Pat, also an excellent historian.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
And I love seeing that you held that chair, Kort. I think that's fantastic.
Me too.
You also co-directed the Center of Hellenic Studies in Washington, D.C., with your wife, Debbie Boedeker, who's also a distinguished classicist. You've lectured, I think it's fair to say, around the world multiple times, and have published over 20 volumes, either written, edited, or co-edited. In fact, the list I have here stops well back before the volume we're even going to discuss today. Your most recent work that I'm aware of, most recent book, is an edition of all of Caesar's commentaries and the commentaries associated with Julius Caesar, the landmark Julius Caesar, which we're going to talk a lot about in the second segment today. Brendan has his copy. I have mine sitting right here. I think it's the most impressive edition of an ancient author that I've ever seen. It's simply fantastic.
As Jay will tell you, I've read Caesar's commentaries several times. I was a classics minor at Reed College. I read with John Morrison, the military historian, he used to teach there occasionally when he came from Cambridge. I have to say this is the finest volume, single volume of the commentaries and of any ancient writings in terms of the annotation, the maps, everything. It just is an absolute superior achievement in every way.
Took me 9 years of my life.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember us going to lunch for many years in a row and me asking you what you were doing and you sort of putting your head in your hands and saying, I'm still working on the Caesar commentary. But, you know, what we usually do, Court, is ask our guests, you know, how did you become a historian? Why a historian? Why a classicist? Okay. You know, what got you to the place where you are now?
Well, when I grew up, I lived from age 11 in Basel in Switzerland, which has a distinguished, very old university. And I went to the classical high school. That was what you did if you wanted to have a good education. It was a high school cum middle school, so I entered it in fifth grade, and so classics was very much emphasized. We had 8 years of Latin, and we started out with 7 hours per week of Latin, and then we had also Greek, and we also had French, of course, because that was the second national language in Switzerland. And then, you know, even English at some point on an optional basis. But I loved history, and I loved the ancient languages and the literature. And I was a reluctant but good math and physics student. And my greatest triumph at that time was that at our graduation dinner, my Latin teacher and my math teacher fought with each other into which field I should go. For me, that was no question. Yep. But so I started studying at the university, the ancient languages and history, general history. And I got my middle school diploma in all these three fields. And then I narrowed it down to ancient history. For the upper high school diploma. And then for the PhD, I sort of combined my love of the languages and literatures and history. And I ended up writing on Julius Caesar. In Switzerland and Germany at the time, it was common that the professor would sort of give a topic to the student. He would, of course, talk with the student, but then he would say, this would be a good topic for you. And my own professor, Christian Meyer, who is now one of the great eminent scholars in Germany and still very active with age 91.
Wow.
He took me on long walks in the surroundings of Basel, and we just talked. And he wanted to know what I was interested in. And he sort of mentioned a number of possible topics and authors we might work on. And my problem was at the time that the chair in ancient history had been vacant for 4 years. And in the first year, my first semester, there was still an ancient historian, very distinguished, Huguenot from Geneva, who was the most boring lecturer who can imagine. And in his
there's always that danger with your Huguenot lecturers, Kurt.
And in his seminar, there were a couple of beginners. We would sit at one end of a long table, and at the other end were the professor and his assistant. And this seminar was on epigraphy. And he told me when I introduced myself to him, he said, oh, you have to come to my seminar. It is on epigraphy. It will be very interesting. And so on. So I sat there, and they never cared to explain anything to us beginners. They just talked with each other about these inscriptions, and we were supposed to learn by osmosis, so to speak. It is a miracle that I still became an ancient historian, because that experience was all about not wanting to do that.
But it does explain why you never became an epigraphist, though.
Certainly helps explain that. So anyway, when Christian Meyer came to Basel in his first professorship, so I was waiting for a professor to be able to write a dissertation with. So I never had really formal training in ancient history, but Meyer was certainly not into these technical disciplines like numismatics or epigraphy. But we took these long walks, since I didn't know very much, when he mentioned Caesar, I said, oh, I know who Caesar is. Let's talk about Caesar. And really, that's how I came to, he said, you know, this would be, this topic which I wrote about was the political strategy of Caesar and Pompey in their civil war of 49-48. And so the political strategy, not the military strategy. And it turned out that this was a really interesting topic, but he said, I know that this is a topic that can be done and that you will be able to succeed with your dissertation, but what kind of level of appraisal it will get, that depends entirely on you. You could get Rite, which was just passed, and then you could cum laude and magna cum laude and insigni cum laude. And so these were the four grades that you could get. And he said, that's up to you. And so I started to work on Caesar. I wrote this dissertation, learning on the way. And when I gave him my first chapter, which was a huge chapter, he read it and he said, this is very interesting. There are some gems hidden in there, but have to find them. You're like a little boy in a beautiful garden. You walk on the path and then you see a beautiful butterfly on the right and you go and explore the butterfly. Then you see a beautiful flower on the left and you go explore that. And eventually, you know, you have sort of nice butterflies and flowers. It doesn't really cohere. He liked to talk in these images. And so anyway, I passed the dissertation with a decent grade. And then I taught high school. And for 2 years, that's what I always wanted to be. I wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. It was a very good experience for me. And I learned teaching.
Court, was that teaching in Switzerland?
Yes.
You were teaching in high school in Switzerland? This is strange. You're our second guest in a row who's taught in a Swiss high school.
Really?
Because Robin Metcalf, remember that? She had that thing on her thing. It's strange.
Yeah. Oh, great.
It's strange, yeah.
So I taught for 2 years. I loved it. And I learned teaching. And that came to be a great asset for me because you can't fake teaching.
That's the truth.
You can fake it in college or university, but you can't in high school. So I learned teaching, and then but I missed doing the scholarship because I'd really enjoyed that. And if you teach 25 hours per day, you can't per week, you can't do any research. So I visited Meyer, who was by then in Cologne. And we took long walks again, and we sort of mapped out the possible career for me. And then he wrote to me at some point and said, well, there's a position in Berlin that might be for you. You could apply. And I did.
And wow.
My early career was all sort of a run of surprises and obstacles, but it all worked out fine. I got a phone call from the professor who was in Berlin at the Free University. You know, it's called Free University because it was the university that where the professors had left the Humboldt University that happened to be in the center of Berlin, which the communists took over. And so they staged a big emigration from there into the Western sector and built this new university called a Free University because they could express their own free views.
Right,
and they couldn't no longer in East Berlin.
That's an important quality in a university and one that we've talked about many times on the Historian.
So I don't know how much you want me to talk about my early career.
Well, there's one more question I want to ask you, but we're going to have to hold it until our next segment. So we'll take our first break.
Hi, this is Mike DeStasio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550. And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com. You can climb a mountain.
You can swim the sea. There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee, available at your local supermarket.
All right, we're back with the historians. We're here with our special guest, Professor Kort Roflob, ancient historian, Greek historian, Roman historian, one of the most eminent classicists in the world today, my own teacher at Brown University, I'm proud to say. And Kort, the question I want to ask you, holding over from the previous segment, is what did your family think about this choice of a career? Did you ever get any kind of, you know, like, why are you going to do that? Why don't you do something else?
No, actually not, for two reasons. My own father was a farmer's son from the mountains in Switzerland, and he became a primary school teacher and then went on to work for a mission society in Cameroon, in Africa, where I was born. And so he was a teacher, and he thought it was great that I wanted to be a teacher. And the second reason was that in the high school I went to, the classical high school in Basel, they, until pretty much my time, the best students became either pastors, ministers, or teachers. And so it was perfectly fine with them. And when I decided to become an ancient historian, of which both my parents knew virtually nothing, we went on long walks in the woods around Basel on Sundays. This was a family tradition. And they just asked me, tell us about what you are learning. Tell us about what this is all about. When I wrote my dissertation, they wanted to know what this was about. And I tried to explain it to them. So they were extremely supportive. And whatever I wanted to do that was good for me, I was fine with them.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Brendan, I don't know if we've ever talked about whether your parents were supportive when you decided you wanted to become a historian or not. They were.
Yeah, pretty much they were. My father was an iron worker. You know, my mother sorted mail on a loading dock. But they were both very relaxed. You know, they were both like, if that's what you want to do. And also when I went to graduate school, since they weren't paying for it, they were fine.
Well, that's great. My father was probably a little less enthusiastic about my choice than either of your fathers. But Kort, I have to say, this story about Christian Meyer and you taking these walks was a legendary story among the graduate students at Brown. But like all oral tradition, it gets elaborated and grows, right? And the version of it I heard was that he took you on this cross-country skiing thing where he made you ski with him like 15 miles to the top of some mountain and then got you up there and said, don't you think you want to do Caesar? And then you spoke.
I don't think I ever said anything.
No, of course not.
No.
But people tell the story. You know, it was probably Walt Stevenson.
I think
one of our friends. It was probably Walt.
Oh, well, Meyer would be as surprised as I am because I don't think he ever put a foot in a ski. to walk, but not to ski, I think.
Well, I'm going to admit when people ask me about you, I always tell the story with the skis.
Okay.
So just so we know how the oral tradition actually works.
Yes, exactly.
But it is true that he got you on the track of Caesar.
Right.
And that your first book, which I think grew out of that dissertation.
I had written it. Meyer's last comment on my dissertation was, and he showed it to me, it was in his written report to the faculty. And he said, this dissertation is like a hen in eggshells. And he showed it to me, and I said, I understand, I can read the words, but I have no idea what you're talking about. And he said, well, put it aside for a while, at least half a year, if not a year, then take it out again and read it again, and then you will start to understand. And what he meant was that I had initially had a concept, and as I worked on it, I grew out of this concept. And the dissertation, the book, or the station that resulted did no longer fit the initial concept, but the structure was still based on that initial concept. And so he said, you know, you have to take it apart and rewrite it, do some additional research in various areas and restructure it so that it fits actually the new concept, which has come out and which is much more important and interesting.
Well, the book that grew out of that, Dignitatis Contentio, which is a phrase of Caesar's describing his struggle over his dignity. And the reason he's fighting is for the dignitas, for Caesar's own dignity, pride, honor. It's a concept hard for, I think, a modern American to
it's
really grasp.
Sort of the status that you have earned status. With your deeds. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting that your career started with this really important book on Caesar, and then you went through you went in several different directions through the rest of your career, writing about archaic Greek history, the origins of freedom. You had a book, the Entdeckung der Freiheit, the
origins discovery of freedom,
discovery of freedom,
out in English in the English edition, yeah,
right, and then work on archaic polis. Lots of stuff on the early Roman constitution and the struggle of the orders in early Rome, on Augustus Caesar.
Yeah.
And yet you come back to Caesar now.
I didn't do anything with Caesar for the longest time. And then in the early 2000s, I was invited by Elaine Phantom to participate in a conference which she had organized on Caesar. And she wanted me to revisit the issue of Caesar and freedom. And I did that, and I discovered that actually there was much more to be said than I had initially, even in my dissertation, discovered. And that brought me back to Caesar. And then I planned to do a commentary, which unfortunately hasn't been done, together with Cynthia Damon and Greg Booker, on a commentary on Caesar's Civil War, a really updated, new, modern commentary. And then I learned about these landmark editions, and I wrote to Strassler, Bob Strassler, whether he wanted a landmark Civil War. And he wrote back and said, oh, we are already doing a Gallic War. And that I took this to mean that he was not interested in a civil war. But then 2 weeks later, he wrote and said he talked with the publisher. And they thought the idea of having a complete Caesar would be absolutely fascinating. And
well, I think our listeners should know that this landmark series that you're referring to.
I explain who he is?
Well, the guy who edited it, Robert Strassler, is an amateur historian, Harvard educated, wrote several papers on Pylos and Sphacteria, battles in the Peloponnesian War, and he did a version of Thucydides with.
He was asked to teach a semester at Bard College, and in teaching that, he was so frustrated with the existing translations because, you know, the penguins and so on filling the whole page. And then at the end, you have two maps with 1,000 names where you can't find what you're looking for. And you have a few notes. And he said, there must be a much, these turn the students off. And there must be a way to do it that they are turned in and they want to read this. And so he devised this concept of these landmark editions, which is really a brilliant concept, namely that you have a larger format. You have the chapters with the translation, and on the margin, you have a very brief summary, two sentences of what's happening in this chapter, together with the date and the place. And then you have the footnotes right at the bottom of the page that explain what you're reading about. And then every few pages, you have a map with just the names that occurred since the last one. And then you have pictures and you have appendices that help the reader, especially the general reader to whom these volumes are addressed, to find ways of understanding better what the author is doing.
Right. Yeah. So these editions are aimed right at the kind of people that listen to the historians. Yeah. And if there's someone who out there who's not a trained historian or not a trained classicist or whatever, you know, and they want to read about the Peloponnesian War, probably the best place you could send them is to the landmark edition of Thucydides.
Yes.
Where they'll be taken through it. Yes. With maps and glossary and definitions and notes that help them get through it.
Yeah.
Brent, you know, in a way, these landmark editions remind me in some ways of the editions that were done in the 19th century, these deluxe editions done by scholars.
Right.
That were explanatory and had wonderful maps.
Yes.
And of course, they're even more than that, because they contain scholarly essays in the end. I mean, your volume on Caesar has, I mean, the web edition must have 50 or 60?
Not quite. We have a total of about 43.
Okay, 43.
Only 43, Cork.
Yeah, essays written by extremely eminent scholars on very technical but important subjects like logistics.
Right.
You know, things like how did they get the stuff they need to move the army around?
Right, right. So, It's really a little encyclopedia about Caesar helping scholars. And we also put up a new timeline that has never been done thoroughly for the Gallic War, which is very difficult because Caesar himself doesn't give us dates and times and distances and anything like that, because his readers wouldn't know Gaul and wouldn't be interested in that. So, we used all kinds of ways of putting this together. And I think what we have is a much better and reliable timeline of any of the Gallic War that ever existed. So this is one of the little side products which, you know, allowed me to do a little bit of original scholarship while doing a lot of work for the notes and for the... Then the translator dropped out halfway through. She wrote a first draft, and then she said she couldn't handle it. She felt that I was badgering her because she was no historian and she had no idea of war. And she was also a little bit of a prima donna by wanting to create new terms, not using the words that other translators have used.
Yeah.
And so she came up with completely new words that nobody would understand. And I had to tell her, look, a baggage train is a baggage train. You can't say movable goods.
Well, it's also true that she's violating the spirit of Caesar's own works, which are extremely clear and precise and tend to use...
Well, the translation was not bad. I mean, I inherited it because Strassler had paid her. And then when she dropped out, she said, I don't want to have anything to do with this anymore. So he said, okay, we are going to use it and revise it and all that. And I want to know that this is okay with you. And so I explained that very carefully in the volume. I spent so much time on revising and improving the translation that I can really, with good conscience, say this is my translation. But I used, you know, at least half of the words are hers. Lots of ands and these and so.
Well, the translation that you produced in the end is extremely good. It's very clear. It rings of Caesar's clarity and precision. And you know, I wonder if we're going to ask you about your view of Caesar as a statesman and a general. But I wonder if, having worked on the translation, how your opinion of Caesar as a man of letters changed, if it did at all.
Well, I was never aware. Before I wrote a chapter for the new Cambridge Companion on the works of Julius Caesar, on Caesar and politics and literature at the end of the Roman Republic, and I looked really into this side of Caesar, this intellectual side. And it's absolutely amazing, because Cicero thought he was one of the best orators that ever was, based on a few speeches he gave as a young man. He was an expert in Latin language, the purity and clarity of the Latin language. He even wrote a book on this, which he dictated to his secretaries while he was riding across the Alps to join the army in Gaul.
This was the guy who knew how to multiply.
And Cicero was full of praise of this. And yeah. says, you know, he is really the expert in the... Cicero wrote a completely different style, but he was able to recognize that here is a man who really has control over the language and knows right. what he's doing. Now, Caesar, of course, wanted to reach lots of people who were not educated, and he wanted them to be able to understand what he was writing and not be distracted by all the decorations and all the stylistic things that Cicero added to it. So he was a poet. Augustus didn't think he was such a great poet. He was, yeah.
But so if you get praise from Cicero, who was a man with quite an ego himself, that really says something.
Absolutely, yeah.
We're coming up on our second break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
When you're working, the hours can be really early, causing drowsiness that inhibits productivity. That's why I like to start every morning with a cup of Joe by New England Coffee. New England Coffee is made from only the finest coffee beans from Africa, Central, and South America. New England Coffee offers tons of different options, covering all over the light to dark roast spectrum, so you can find that perfect sweet spot for your coffee cravings. Next time you need a wake me up, choose New England Coffee. Available at supermarkets, restaurants, and institutional dining areas near you.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking with our very special guest, Professor Kort Roflob of Brown University, my former Roman history professor and much more. But before we get back to his evaluation of Caesar, we want to welcome back one of our earlier historical sponsors, Brendan. I think this is one of your favorites, St. Columban's Genuine Irish Butter.
Love them.
Yeah,
love them.
Brendan, I know there's one thing you really like in the morning, and that's Irish butter on your bagel. But have you ever thought about whether the butter you're using is real, verified, unsalted Irish butter? I mean, butter that's made in Ireland by Irishmen using the milk of proper Irish cows?
It's basically a central obsession with me.
Okay. Well, I know it's a real problem out there verifying this, but a recent joint study by the National Institutes of Health, the Irish Defamation League, and the Boston Celtics showed that over 23% of the butter sold in North America under the moniker Irish had actually been produced outside of the Republic of Ireland and or had been processed by Protestants.
Shocking, now, shocking, shocking.
Now, reaction to that disturbing information was swift and vehement, if not violent. One protest in County Cork attracted over 7 adults and 3 children who displayed placards and banners with the mottos, "Better Butter Now," that was one, "The Pope Loves Irish Butter," and "Cromwell Sucks." That was another thing they were at. Anyway, thankfully, in this overheated environment, one company has stepped forward to ensure the availability of 100% pure dairy spread for your bagel, toast, or scones, St. Columban's Genuine Irish Butter. Although best known for spreading Irish monasticism to mainland Europe in the years around 600 AD, St. Columban devoted his time to more than just creating somewhat stringent and ascetic rules for medieval monastics. Indeed, novices at Columbanic monasteries were required to practice daily confession and penitence, as well as producing 6 quarts of pure butterfat every day. As early as the 8th century, evidence suggests that Columban's genuine Irish butter had become a prized delicacy from the morasses and bogs of Denmark, south to the Alps, even to Basel, and as far east as Constantinople, where the iconoclastic Byzantine Emperor Leo III not only banned religious images, but also attempted to purge the empire of all non-Irish butter, leading to the widespread substitution of olive oil and the development of horiatiki, or Greek salad. In any case, since the early Middle Ages, the name Columban has stood for monastic purity of spirit and rich and delicious 100% pure Irish butter. So the next time you're in the dairy aisle, don't be fooled by false pretenders to the throne of creamy spreads. Look for St. Columban's genuine Irish butter and enjoy a truly delicious and beatified breakfast.
St. Columban's. It's not good for your heart, but it'll fortify your soul.
It's not good for your heart. Really? You don't think
Well, any butter is bad for your heart.
Well, I like it, even so.
Yeah, me too. I don't care.
Boy, I'm betting you eat real butter on your breakfast toast. Is that right? Are you a user?
Court.
Are you a user of genuine
butter? No, I'm not actually.
Oh, no.
But Debbie does.
Okay, all right.
And then I'm in Switzerland, I do. Use butter.
Yeah. Probably Swiss butter, though. It's not.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Well, look, we wanted to drag you into this debate about Caesar.
Yeah.
As a statesman and as a general, as a historical figure, full stop. And I will just say that I heard you give a talk probably 4 or 5 years ago at the New England Ancient Historians Colloquium, in which you were commenting on a paper about Cato. Cato the Younger.
Yes.
And it was the best commentary I have ever heard on an ancient history lecture. And one of the things you said in that talk was, if I have to choose between Cato and Caesar, I will choose Caesar. And you could hear the wind coming out of the surrounding ancient historians who felt like they had all been punched in the stomach. This is Cord Rothlop saying, I choose Caesar over Cato. So maybe you can use that as a way to, why do you think Caesar is a preferable choice over Cato the Younger?
Well, you know, Cato had this reputation from antiquity to be a sort of a saint. Mm-hmm. He was a Stoic the way the Romans were Stoics, which was a very modified and superficial version of it. And he decided not to submit to Caesar in the civil war because he refused to submit to live under a tyrant. And he committed suicide rather than capitulate. And that made him the hero of Republican traditions and ideals. In antiquity and far beyond. But if you look at Cato's career, it is a very mixed bag. He was corrupt like everybody else. He took his family over the state just like everybody else. And he was, I claim with good reason, the single most responsible for the outbreak of the civil war, not Caesar. Caesar made tremendous sacrifices and offered compromises to avoid it, so that even Pompey and all the others agreed, and the civil war could have been avoided, except that Cato said, when it comes to the state, no compromises are made. And that blew the whole thing apart. So he is, in my view, a very mixed personality with a vastly overrated reputation.
Right.
That's my view. Now, if Caesar deserves to be preferred to him, that's a completely different question. The reason why I think Caesar is a very important and interesting personality and an author of interesting works is that, you know, as you all know, here we have a doer of deeds describing and commenting on his own deeds. Not only just, you know, a little doer, but a big doer, a guy who made history. And to read what he has to say about his own achievements and his struggles is fascinating. Anyway, whatever the content is. But he's also an eminent Roman leader who has a lot to say about what makes a good Roman. And he, in his Gallic War, he describes himself as sort of the ultimate good Roman, and his officers and soldiers as good Romans, as opposed to the barbarians, and his Roman opponents, who are bad Romans. So we learn a tremendous amount from reading his works about what Romanness means or meant at that time. I think for the students, the problem is, for the teachers, the great problem is that this is about war.
Yeah.
I think the work is about much more than war, but it's about war. And some of these wars are unsavory. And some of them are massive massacres and very, very unpleasant to read. And that causes a problem in our critical age that we don't like to heroicize people who did this kind of thing. But in my view, we have to address these issues straightforward. And we have to admit, yes, Caesar actually committed genocide in Gaul. I've examined this in a paper which has been submitted and I hope will be accepted, especially for teachers, because they have to deal with these issues. But we also, and my way of approaching it is to just look at it soberly and say, okay, yes, this meets the category of genocide. But then to say the category of genocide was produced in the 20th century in reaction to the Nazi crimes. And then it's...
Kurt, can I stop you there for a second and about this? I mean, look, we would look at someone like Caesar when he's in Gaul, and of course he goes after specific subcultures, and as you say, he basically annihilates them. And, you know, kills the men and enslaves the women. But as you say, the category of genocide is constructed at the Nuremberg trials in order to, you know, understand or interpret what was done by the Nazis. So what is your feelings, which has become a huge issue in the academy, about taking that construct, which is made in that context of the middle 20th century, and imposing it on Gaul, you know, in the age of
well,
Caesar?
Well, of course, yes, that's my view, too, that it doesn't fit. And we, I think what is useful about this is to examine it, to admit, yes, this in our modern perspective, this is genocide. And then to look at the way the Romans thought about these things and to learn that in history, there are different categories that work and people grow up in traditions that are different. And then, you know, if you look at the reaction of the Romans, except for our old friend Cato, who was an outlier on this again, but for Cicero and for the other Romans, there was no problem at all. You know, this was the way that war was, and that the conquest of the empire had happened in this way. And then I list in this article a couple of examples, Aemilius Paulus after Pydna, where, you know, which compared to which Caesar's massacre of Dusipetes and Tencteri is perfectly normal. So this is a different world. We may not approve of it, but it's a different world, and we cannot condemn people based on our own modern expectations. And then I put the counter example, which is again wonderful in Caesar, because we have on the one hand the brutal conqueror, but we also have the clement victor.
Exactly.
And if you look at the ideal of clemency that Caesar develops in the Gallic War, and then of course applies in the Civil War even more markedly, it is that the fallback position is clemency. If, you know, he offers his enemies all kinds of opportunities to capitulate, and then they will be spared and they will be dealt with in a positive way. But even the defeated opponents, like the Nervii in this very famous battle in the second book, which are almost wiped out, according to Caesar, which is vastly exaggerated, because a few years later they again fielded large armies. But when they capitulate and ask and explain to him what they have lost, he says, "Okay, go home. I will make sure that your neighbors respect you and don't exploit your weakness." And you know, he sends the Helvetii back after their defeat. And he has the neighbors of the Helvetii, the Allobroges, feed them through the first winter because they have nothing left. So this is another side of Caesar, which in my view is the origin of Clementia as a virtue of an emperor.
It's quite remarkable the way Caesar advertises this aspect of his personality, his clemency.
Yes. Yes.
The fact that he expects to get good press for that. He expects the people to say, wow, this Caesar is a good guy. Look at this clemency that he's practicing.
Not all the then people often respond, this is all propaganda. But propaganda is based on facts.
On a reaction.
It doesn't work if it's not based on facts. And in Caesar's case, the words and the deeds fit perfectly together. So you can't just wipe it away as propaganda.
Court, you also have the very, very sad, tragic aspect of Caesar's death, where he has pardoned so many of his enemies and actually brought them into his government so that they're serving under him.
Yeah.
And the fact that some of these people he pardons are the people who end up assassinating him. That's why I don't consider Caesar's assassins to be heroes. They didn't have to accept his clemency. They didn't have to accept the positions in government that he offered them. And so I think that it's understandable that Dante puts Brutus and Cassius in the mouth of Satan in the Inferno as traitors.
Yes, and of course, in addition, they were stupid. And that is even more...
Worse yet, Court! Worse
that
yet.
Is even it's more stupid. Unforgivable than being a traitor. You know, to assassinate him and think that this will take care of the problem.
Yeah, we're coming up on our final break. We're going to be right back with Court Rothlob. We're the historians.
This is Mike Jannetty. Join me every Wednesday afternoon from 12 noon to 2 p.m. for DJ Mike Jannetty's Disco Dance Party on WNTN.
All right, we're back with the historians. We're here with our special guest, Professor Court Rothlob. But for information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at TheRealHistorians@gmail.com. If you like the historians and you want to see the show continue, please write us. Sponsorships are available. Wow, Court, we've been doing a series of shows on the fall of the Roman Republic. And we have had as our idea that we would end this arc talking to you as the preeminent expert on Caesar and the end of the Republic. And it has been extremely satisfying for us to have this conversation with you on the historian. So I'm really, really glad that you agreed to come on.
Thank you. I enjoy it.
It's something I'm sure will never make it onto your CV, but...
It'll make it onto ours, though.
It will make it onto ours. Right. So, and having thanked you that way, we now have to ask you to go through a ordeal that we put our guests through on the historians. And this is a segment that we call overrated or underrated, in which we will present you with a concept or a person or a thing. And you tell us whether you think this thing is overrated or underrated. And then maybe give us just one sentence, you know, or so. Why you think?
Since my reputation is made, I cannot.
That's right. That's right. Right. Your reputation cannot be harmed by overrated or underrated. All right. So here we go. I'm going to start it out. Theodore Mommsen.
Neither over or under. He was an eminent historian.
And okay. So correctly,
tremendous amount of impulses to the discipline of ancient history, even if some of his ideas are no longer at this point accepted.
Okay, all right. The phalanx. The Greek phalanx.
Overrated.
Overrated. Not as big an impact on culture and warfare as historians want to make
it. Well, the debate at this point is whether it was whether there really was a pure phalanx the way that we imagine it.
Okay.
But it certainly was a crucial military development.
Okay.
So you have to have three categories, over, under, or mid.
Okay, mid. All right.
All right. It was good enough to conquer half the world.
All right. Next item, Sparta.
Again, crucially important, probably overrated.
All right, probably overrated. The 12 tables.
A puzzle.
Not going to rate it? What about in terms of scholarly attention?
Overrated.
All right, overrated.
But you see, this is interesting because early Roman history was long done by legal historians. They looked at it from the perspective of law, and that's why the 12 tables became so important.
Yeah.
I don't know if they really were. So
I always tell two people there are two things in classical antiquity I'm not interested in: Roman law and myth. Brendan, you want to give us a few?
Yeah. Carthage.
Underrated.
I agree.
That's a good one. Yeah.
M.I. Finley.
mid, crucially important, but in some ways limited by the times, and his views were, you know, people went beyond his views. But it, at the time, just like Vernon, crucially important in giving new impulses. So you can't say it's overrated, you can't say it's underrated, is justly rated.
All right.
Virgil.
Under.
Underrated. He thinks Michael Putnam is listening. That's why we're getting it.
Ronald Sine.
Oh, good one. Oh, over. You're killing me.
Over.
I knew
you
would
expand a little bit on that.
Overrated in the sense that he almost became like an oracle and a saint.
Yeah.
And people didn't even dare to look at him critically. I was when I did this volume on the fall of the Republic, on the sort of the early principle, I wanted this to be sort of a critical Auseinandersetzung with the idea, with Syme's ideas. And lots of people told me, and Glenn Barasok told me, if you put it this way, you won't get the authors to contribute. They don't want to Auseinandersetz critically with Syme.
Yeah, you're actually right about that. And I could never have admitted that 25 or 30 years ago, but I will admit that you're right. I have to do so.
Spartacus, the movie.
The movie.
The movie, yeah. Kirk Douglas.
I don't know whether I can say it's underrated or overrated. Good. Excellent.
Good, yeah.
I've got three more, Brendan, just so you know.
Wait, I got one more. One more. The French.
The what?
The French people. France. Overrated or underrated?
Overrated.
Yeah. One more and I'm out. I got one more. Providence, Rhode Island.
Oh, come on.
Underrated,
yes.
All right.
Go ahead, Jay.
My next one was going to be about Providence. It was going to be calamari.
Justly overrated.
Yeah, the justly overrated, the fried squid they serve us at every meal in Rhode Island. Okay, I got two more. John Calvin.
An evil spirit.
Okay. So no, he's overrated if you think he's good, and underrated if you think he's bad.
But I mean, he caused a lot of trouble.
Okay.
Court, do you think that that's related to your rejection of that Huguenot lecturer?
I'm a Swiss Protestant, and that includes some Calvinist.
Some Calvinist, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, this is the last one. This is the big one, because you're going to be settling an argument here that Brendan and I have had for 92 episodes.
Okay.
Augustus Caesar.
Cannot be underrated.
Wow.
I think he was just absolutely crucial. And if he had been a little more fortunate with his children and grandchildren, especially with his grandchildren, then I think the Roman Empire would have taken a somewhat different path, probably a better path than it did under these creatures.
Well, Brendan and I have a running argument about whether Julius Caesar or Augustus Caesar or Alexander the Great deserves the greatest man of antiquity title.
Alexander was great as a conqueror.
Right.
Never had a chance to really develop ideas and realize them. Caesar's political legacy is mixed, in my view. He was a visionary. He had ideas that went way beyond what other people in his time saw. But he also had a character that hindered him. He got very angry very quickly and then just said, to hell with you, I do it myself. And that caused a lot of enmities and so on.
All right, I see Brendan is
yeah,
is,
Court, you're my hero. I think you're going to get the title.
Brendan thinks you're supporting his view of Augustus. So
special contributor to the historians.
No, Augustus really had the chance. He was fortunate. I mean, he could have died several times before that. And he had a long life, and he was actually able to introduce reforms that were crucially important. So,
yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll have to put you down as a supporter of Brendan's view of Augustus.
So, yeah. Augustus.
I should have known.
Augustus makes the Mediterranean. He builds the institutions. He was not the conqueror or the writer or anything that Caesar or the conqueror that Alexander was or the conqueror writer, but he makes the institutions that endure for hundreds and hundreds of years.
You don't have to bounce the rubble, for heaven's
sake. Bounce the rubble, yes.
You win, I lose. Fine.
Right.
Excited. Brendan, before we thank our guest again, is there anything in historical news that you want to we have to get out this week that you need to let our listeners know about?
There's a ton of things, but I did want to mention one of the people that we normally talk about here on The Historians, sort of our guiding light, Robin Lane Fox, garden columnist and famous ancient historian.
Yes, I'm sure Court knows him.
You know him?
Yes, I know him. I met him. Ryder in the movie Alexander.
Yes, exactly. We talk about him almost every week. He had a superb column in about the history of the bumblebee in England. Yes, the bumblebee history and bumblebee preservation. But there's been a decline of bumblebees in England, and he blames
Brexit.
No,
badgers.
Yes, badgers. He says here in his column. At the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, badgers feast on the bees' nests undeterred by stings. They eat the young bees and the larvae and wipe out a nest emerging. He goes on for an entire column trying to blame badgers because he hates badgers because they rip up his garden every spring. So,
Robin Lane Fox has written this gardening column for how long, Brendan, in the Financial Times? 40 years, something like that?
50 years, I think it is, Court.
Goodness, yeah. No.
Yeah,
he's written thousands of these gardening columns, and he also did the scholarly work that he did, and it is very funny, learned column. But he really knows, has an interesting take, but his views of Brexit and badgers lead him down.
He hates them both.
But he hates them both. I mean, it's a strange thing.
Outspoken critic of Brexit and badgers. All right. Well, Brendan, if you don't have any other items from historical news that we need to go through.
I have a ton of obituaries, but I don't know if I want to end with just throwing in some people.
You should let your readers and your listeners know that this landmark Julius Caesar is actually a big book, but is also very cheap. You can get it at Amazon for about $30 or so.
Thank you for bringing that up, Court. And it's good to bring this up again. Brendan and I are both holding our volumes here. If anybody that wants to know about Roman history, or especially about Julius Caesar, you can't do better than this volume. The introduction alone will set you exactly where you need to be, and then you will be guided through with maps, images, coins, pictures, and commentaries that explain every concept you're going to run up on. It's just a treasure trove. For anybody interested.
I'm advertising it not because I get money from it. I probably will get royalties in 10 years when Chrysler has paid off all his investment.
the production costs on something like this, I can't even imagine.
It's got to be astronomical. Yeah. But Court, I would say my son takes Latin. He's been doing Latin for a number of years. He's now in the going into the eighth grade at Boston College High School. He does the Latin, and I was showing him the maps and stuff. It's the kind of thing where if you're in the 13 years old and you're interested in Caesar and war, you can look at this and think, wow, this is really great. Really is just a superb, superb volume. We are up on time. And
we want to make sure we thank Court again. And I just want to say thanking you not just for being on The Historians, but for being the teacher, the advisor, counselor, restrainer, and friend that you have been to me over the years. And I'll just say, as much as I admire you as a scholar, I admire you even more as a man and as a person.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. We have to get together for one of our lunches again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Court, thanks so much for coming on. We are up on time. It's been a fantastic visit. We hope you'll come on again. We'll be back soon. We're The Historians.
Thank you.